Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are and where we come from. So who are you and where did you come from?
My name is David O'Reilly and I'm originally from Dublin, Kilmana and Lucan.
And where are you living now?
I'm living in London. I've lived in London for the last 13 years now. So, yeah, I'm a bit of both.
Bit of both, because you can hear it in your accent.
Do you know what? Everyone says that, but I think... Because I pronounce my THs, it's because if you don't over there, they're like, oh, what is that? Tree. And it's like, oh, Jesus. So you just kind of get, you're subconsciously trying to raise it.
Yeah.
But when I go back now, after being here for like 2 months, the Brits will be like, oh, yeah, look, listen, God, you've been home, haven't you? So it's mad. It is mad.
Okay, and before we get into all that, so we know each other through Elaine and the Elaine Show.
Yeah.
And you were doing some, you were on the panel and doing showbiz reporting for her. But then I got to know you through Instagram and looking at your page and stuff like that. I wanted to sit down with you because I just think you have this colourful life that I want to hear all about. But I just want to hear about it from the very beginning. So how many in the family in Kilmana, and take it from there for me.
So yeah, I was first born to Liz and Tom, both originally from Ballyfermot. We then lived in Kilmana. That's where they lived when I was born. And then I have a younger brother, Joseph, 4 years younger than me as well. And my childhood was a game of two halves, really, because my home life was incredible. You couldn't ask for better parents. You couldn't ask for a more loving home. Any hobbies we wanted to do, we got to do it. We were around our grandparents. I had a lot of strong women in my family, on both sides, my mom and my dad. But then school was a little bit more tumultuous. I was obviously a young queer child growing up in a country that still hadn't come to terms with what that enabled or what that meant. And I was a chatty child. I wanted to chat. And that was the thing, is that like some parents will tell their kids to shut up now, stop talking now. But my mum embraced. She wanted to, we were allowed to have an opinion. You know, we were able to talk to her. She would talk to us. And I had that with my nannies as well, and my aunties and my cousins and stuff, and my uncles. So to then go to school, and I didn't enjoy the process of being, I was scared to do something wrong in case I got in trouble. But then if I was chatty, then I'd have the piss taken out. Can you swear in this?
Yeah.
You'd have the piss taken out of you. So I was this chatty little gay kid growing up. And, you know, then started, when I got older, to put a little bit of weight on. So then my physical attributes would be taken. And it just got more toxic as the years went on. And it kind of had it. We had one amazing teacher who, when it all stopped. But then the minute we got another teacher then for my sixth class, it just went all, it was just horrible. It was, and the problem was, it didn't just affect me, it affected my whole family. Because I was coming home, I was so unhappy. And my mum and dad had built me back up and then sent me off again the next day. So, you know, there was a lot of hard conversations. Mum and dad wanted to move when we were younger, and for some reason I was scared. But then we ended up did moving once I was a little bit older, and it was probably the best decision we ever made.
What was happening in school?
It started out with, you know, just the usual name calling and kind of picking on. And for me, I felt like I could deal with it back then, you know. I was actually reading one of my reports the other day. I had a load of reports. I mean, it's mad. These teachers are like, David needs to work on his handwriting, and they're writing in hieroglyphics themselves. I'm like, are you mad? Writing in, it needs to work on his writing. And then one of them wrote, easily upset by others. And I was like, that was when I was really being badly bullied, like, and how clueless of a teacher must you be to not have even seen that? Then it would go, then for class, I just remember fourth class being really, really hard. We had a new teacher and things just kind of stepped up a notch, and it was, people were venomous to me. I'd go on holiday and I'd come back and my books would have David is gay written in them. In the toilets on the wall, David is gay written on them. They would call me names about, you know, you know, listen, I've got an arse now, you know, I've got a big arse. I'm not afraid to show it now, you know, I'm a proud fatty. But, they'd say duck arse, you know, David's fat, David's gay. I remember one time when my brother was really struggling at school, and I went down to be with him on his play, his breaks.
Yeah.
So he'd have a little bit of familiarity, and I remember him going back into his class and he was absolutely terrorised. He was crying. He was just getting used to school.
Yeah.
And I went back into my class and I burst into tears. But instead of taking me outside and asking me what's wrong, the teacher took me to the top of the classroom and in front of everyone asked me what's wrong. So all the focus was on me crying, and they seen that as a weakness. And kids, listen, kids are kids, but it was almost like blood in front of wolves, do you know what I mean? Then kind of stopped in fifth class, and then sixth class was just vile again. I remember at one point I was in a circle with everyone in my class and they were pushing and pointing at me, calling me a loner. And at one point I remember walking down to the principal's office. I just went up during the playtime, walked into the building, got my bag and walked down to the principal's office. And I said, I don't want to be here anymore. And I was crying. I've got no friends. I have no friends. And two of the bullies followed me down and stood in the room as well. And he went, well, you do. Look, there's two friends there. And I'll never forget that shock of thinking, Jesus Christ. This is, I felt so, so blindsided. I just felt like, what is happening here? Like, I was so young and all I wanted to do was please people and talk to people and be nice and be, you know, creative and just be myself, my authentic self. But I wasn't even able to be just not like what I would have considered just have a typical kind of school day. They were just having none of it. And like, I mean, my mum remembers telling me that she went down to the principal at one point and he said, well, you know, some kids are meant to be bullied and some kids are meant to be bullies. And I will never forget that. And my mum was, she said she absolutely let him have it then. She just really read him a new one. There was another time where then a group of friends out of, you know, in my, who I thought were in my class that were friends would text me when we just started getting phones then, come and meet us at the garage. And then I'd go to the garage and they wouldn't be there. And they say, come and meet us on the gar pitch. I'd go to the gar pitch and they wouldn't be there. Come and meet us at Sean's. I'd go to Sean's and they wouldn't be there. And like, I was just, it was just awful. I was given the run around. They preyed on my vulnerability and they wore me down to the point where when I went to secondary school, I literally just kept my head down as best I could to avoid bringing any attention onto myself. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer to
I want from you. Go on a bit about that, because it's just horrible that someone would diminish you, and you know.
Yeah, do you know what? It was so. You know, we went to a psychologist and everything to try and, as a family to try and, you know, and this is, I don't think I've ever been so open about this, like, on a public forum before. Like, we've always spoke about, you know, my mental health as a subsequent to the bullying and stuff like that. But we never kind of got real into, you know, as a family, like, how that impacted the lot of us. And actually, I'm so glad that in the 4 years that are between me and my brother, we had moved by the time Joseph was going to secondary school, and he just flourished and he was able to be his authentic self. And he was such a strong and loved person. And it was just that difference of 4 years for me was just so, it felt like a million years, the two experiences that we kind of had. Now, I'm not saying Joshua didn't experience anything, but just that time in primary school, for the latter half of the primary school, was just so toxic. And I mean, even now, like, if we go by the primary school that I went to, I'm 34 now, and I literally, I feel like a whole shade of darkness comes over me, and my anxiety will be like sky high, just because it triggers so many kind of memories, and it's had such a profound effect on me as a person with paranoia, with regards to thinking people are talking about me if they're not, and being defensive. And kind of, I've had to really work on that. And it's so, you know, Irish people were amazing. You know, that we have so many kind of attributes that other cultures don't have. Mm. One of our biggest faults is that kind of burnout. It's all right, just get on with it, stand up and get on with it and do it. And I'm not saying that that is what happened to me, because it certainly didn't. My mum and dad didn't do that, but the infrastructure of the school did that to me. And yeah, I just hope that we've come on now, that that's not happening still in working class areas where children, and that's what really worries me about the whole, you know, I'm not a member of the trans community, I'm a member of the LGBTQIA plus community, but that's what's so triggering about people with regards to children and being taught about trans education and non-binary education and gender studies, because it just worries me that these kids who are so scared and who are just getting to know themselves will think that this world is just full of so much hate, because you can only draw on the experiences that you're living through. So for me, I definitely think being called so gay caused me to come out so late.
Really?
Yeah, I was 22 when I came out. Like, now people are coming out when they're kids now. Mm-hmm. The days they're saying, you know, or they're teenagers. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong on that.
No, you're right.
But I was 22, like, that was so late. Like, and I only did it because I had a boyfriend. I got a boyfriend. And I feel like that was because I had built up a perception, a narrative in my head, that being gay was wrong. Because I was always told it was used as an insult. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It was always used as
that's so gay.
You're so gay. Mm. You know, using the word faggot, like, people still don't know the connotation that comes with that word. And listen, I'm not one of these people who say take it out of songs and all that. I think leave it in, but just acknowledge that the word can and have, has done damage to people, because it's used as a weapon. It's used to hurt people, you know. They use that word to hurt people, and they, you know, so for me, it has had such a profound effect on me as an adult, that bullying and that kind of primary school era, that, like I said, secondary school was just a kind of just try and get through it as quick as possible, keep my head down and just deal with it.
Do you know what's mad? Because it's not mad, but I always say that all the time, that you've just said that about the song, because, you know, you're a scumbag, you can't get, and I was like, when Ed Sheeran, I think, was he who sang it on the Late Late, and it was uproar, and I was kind of going, Jesus Christ, that's terribly had to change the song. And you've literally just made me go, light bulb moment, Rebecca. It was used as a weapon. And I never thought of that, David. Never.
It was. And, you know, what's really hard is, and like I say, I'm not one for saying take it out. It was written at the time, but I think we need to understand that for some people, you know, it's the word that they hear when they're being battered on the streets. You know, this year alone, the rise in hate crimes towards gay people and trans people has gone through the roof. And that word is used as an insult. It's used as a weapon, like I said. Mm. And I think it's so hard to try and explain that. So it's so lovely to hear you say that, because I love that you've said that. Like, often the kind of the, you know, like I said, I'm not one of these people that get rid of it, take it out of the song. But what I will do is try and explain to people, this is maybe why it's insulting. And there's nothing worse when someone turns around and goes, oh, well, then what about scumbag? Mm. Okay. I that's not the same thing, but okay. You know, and you can only take a horse to water. You can't make a drink. And I find that with having, like, really easy conversations is the way that we'll get rid of a lot of these kind of things. Because people just don't understand. And even, like, my mum and dad, like, born in the 60s in Ballyfermot, a different era. It's all about change, evolve, and I will evolve as a person, and there'll be things that I'll be like, oh, I don't get in a few years, and people will explain to me. And I think doing what you do so brilliant is, and why I love your podcast so much, is that you just listen to people, and it's not, there's nothing, there's no agenda, there's no politics, there's no kind of socioeconomic kind of prejudice. You just speak with people, and it's just human to human, and at the end of the day, that's all we really want is conversations between people.
Yeah, because, like, and I think a lot of people will be like, wow. Because, like, that was just a wow moment for me. That's, like, something I never, ever taught. And so I do apologise
for that.
Like, because I never realised that I was used as a... And it was. And it only was recently, and we can talk about that in a few minutes. Can I ask you, were you ever envious of Joe that he wasn't being bullied compared to you, or he didn't have the same...
No, because I was very protective of him. Mm. Even as a baby, like when we were kids, I was always so protective of him. And for me, there was a real kind of pride seeing him flourish. And even now, like, he gives me confidence to be an authentic version of myself. Like, even like, you know, when I went to the Jamie movie press a few months ago for the world premiere of the film, and we were told to go glamorous and full out, and I picked an outfit, and I put it on, and I remember that day going, I can't wear it. And he went, David, you look amazing. And I was like, oh, okay. And it was a big zebra print kind of two-piece suit. Everyone thought it was expensive. I got it on boohoo.com with a tiny little thing, got a shirt, you know, with a nice, like, what you call
cravat.
It? Cravat collar thing. And I wore it and I felt amazing, and he built me up. So there was never any jealousy. There was never any kind of competition between the two of us. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people would want, and a lot of people would say to Joseph, are you jealous of Dave? Or, you know, because even work-wise, careers and stuff like that, we're each other's biggest hype men. I know that maybe sounds weird, but we really are. So there was never that growing up. And I was just glad that Joseph didn't have to experience what I did, because it would kill me to know that someone that I loved so much, my brother, would potentially go through the hurt that I did. That would just, I think that'd be harder maybe than even acknowledging it myself.
And you said there about the psychologist. So what did you have to go for, and how did your mum and dad help you with that? Because you're very, I'm actually moving away from the word lucky. I'm moving away from that lucky and saying very blessed. You're very blessed to have the parents that you have, because not everyone is as blessed as you to have those parents. Yeah. So do you want to tell me a little bit about psychologists and stuff like that?
Yeah, it was something that I think mum obtained, and it was for the family, because I said, you know, bullying doesn't just affect the child. These parents are going to bed racked to worry every night, wondering, is today going to be the day he gets more verbal abuse? Is today going to be the day he gets picked on? Is today going to be the day he's going to get pushed, or another day where we have to build him back up again? Is he going to be continuing to lash out again?
Were you lashing out?
I was so lashing out, there was times when I look back and I was so angry with, for a kid, like, I was happy because of my circumstances, but I dread to think if I didn't have such an amazing mum and dad, where it would have left, would have led me, you know. But the psychologist, it was just one session, and we went to Trinity College, and we sat down as a family, and we were all kind of asked and spoken to, and it was really interesting. I got mum to fish out some, I was filling out a form the other week, and mum fished out a couple of files, you know, mums that like to keep it. It's Dublin City Bank in there with the mental file she's got. And it was my school reports, but then also a sheet from the psychologist that they broke it down about, like, what, you know, from life we need and stuff like that. And I think going to see the psychologist was, I didn't know it was a psychologist. I think I thought it was a counsellor at the time, maybe. But it was good because actually, as a family, we could speak about it. And I knew that these three people had my back no matter what. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And for me, it was literally what got me through, was the three of them were the thing that got me through that, you know, and I always had my back. And you know, I was very lucky. I've got some amazing grandparents, and in particular, my mom's mom, Kitty. She went through so much in her life, but her tenacity and her pure resilience was such an inspiration to me, and to see how far she'd come, and, you know, the way she was a mother to her kids and a wife, and to the darkest of times in Ireland where women were running houses on no money. Like, it was so inspiring. And even at that age to see her, you know, that was always very inspiring. And the same with my Nanny O'Reilly, because she did the same thing as well. But yeah, that was kind of what the psychology was. It was a reinforcement of, of knowing. I mean, for me, the kind of maybe clinical aspect of it didn't kind of sit with me until like now, when I go to a psychologist now, you know, and speak and have therapy and stuff, which, you know, I would advise anybody to have. I think it's so important to check in with our mental health and stuff like that. But yeah, so the psychologist was just a little check-in, say, actually, do you know what, these people have my back. We as a family are going to deal with this, and deal with it we did, you know.
Good. And come here, tell me, did you, when you were going through secondary and all, did you always want to get into drama and all of that? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I did. You know, from a young age, I did drama at primary school. It was one of my outlets after school. There was an after-school drama club, and I loved it. Because I loved it. It was so, so good. It was just, I never felt that. It was like a drug, do you know what I mean? It was like just this adrenaline. Like, it was just amazing. I loved it. And then, going to secondary school, I started playing the violin. I played the violin for 10 years, but I think I was afraid at secondary school to join the drama group. So I think what happened was, it was like, oh God. And I think my mum had seen how happy I was doing drama. And then when I was about 14, 15, a cousin in Lucan was going to a drama school, a musical theatre, performing arts school. And my mum said, well, do you want to try and go to it? And I did. And I fell in love with the classes and some of the teachers. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And then before we know it, I was doing it for like 4 years or 3 years. And then we ended up moving to Lucan. And I changed schools, which I never would have done before. Because I think it was that thing of Stockholm syndrome, you know, I didn't want to move. And we'd kind of, I think, you know, we were ready to move as a family. And we did. And I think it was one of the best things the best gift that my mum and dad ever gave us. It was like a new beginning. It was a fresh start. And we still live there today, and I love it, and I love the life my mum and dad have created there, and I love the friends that they have, and I love the community, and I love what we get from the area, you know. And you know, that was so that area afforded me the opportunity to want to actually kind of align and go, I love it. And then what I did was, I got my Leaving Cert. I got through my Leaving Cert. One of the hardest things, I don't know how people do it. It's over in England, they do like 3 subjects for their A-levels, maybe. Over here, when they find out you do 7 or 8 exams, they're like, what the hell is going on? I mean, it's awful. So I actually went and did a year in Ballyferma in media,
right?
You know, media presentation and training, and written journalism, I think it was called as well. And it was during that year that I got the chance to audition for a college in Dublin over in England. So we weren't even having to go over to London, and it was just done per chance. But then I got it, and yeah, it changed my life.
And can I ask, before we go on to that, can I ask you, when you moved, like, were you then realising I'm free and I can be myself and I can be accepted? Or what age did you feel accepted for being David O'Reilly?
I don't think as a person, I don't think I ever felt accepted until I started to work professionally.
Really?
In 2012, maybe. I was accepted by my mum, my dad, my brother. Like, that was, and my larger family, some of them definitely. But I, as a person, probably not until I started working professionally in musical theatre in 2011, yeah.
That's so sad.
And looking back at it now, I suppose it is really, it's that trauma of, because definitely, like, even like the stuff from primary school filtered into when I was training at musical theatre college, my insecurities carried there, which is already a cesspit of anxiety and insecurities. A drama school, God, fame has nothing on what we experienced, you know what I mean? And to have, it was just such awful side effects from that. And you know, if there is parents listening here that, you know, think their child may be getting bullied, or thinks their child could potentially, I mean, most parents, probably my child wouldn't bully, just check in with them a little bit more, because you could be the difference between a serious amount of trauma later on in your child's life. And I was lucky that the trauma that I experienced was limited, because when I went home, it was the safest place ever. It was the best place ever. So, you know, I couldn't imagine what a child would be going through if they came home from school and then had to experience that. That's just so hard. So, you know, it's had a profound effect on my later life and living authentically. Even like now, like there's things where I'll be like, you know, oh God, maybe I just shouldn't be too camp because that casting director might see my Instagram page. Maybe I shouldn't be too camp because actually they won't think, they might think this. Don't put that photo up. Maybe I've got too, because obviously I'm a lot, I just come out of a musical where I was dressed as a drag queen. Maybe I shouldn't put a picture up because they'll think I'm a drag queen. All these negative connotations, I'm adding all these looks and personalities and sexualities and traits and all. So it definitely has had a profound effect on me. So I would say though, like going back to your original question, it was definitely when I was 2011, so I would have been around 23.
And even like you said, then you had a boyfriend. And can I ask? And it might be a question, a horrible question, but it's sometimes kind of like, just, did you have friends?
No, I didn't. I didn't have friends until we moved to Lucan, and I had girls from the girl, and I actually built up a friendship group around Lucan then at that point. But up until, I didn't have friends, no. I did. I thought I did, and then they didn't, no.
That's so sad.
But you know what? It is sad. But then in another way, then I was rich in cousins. Like, I had so many amazing cousins, and I was so lucky to have them, but I didn't have those friends where I...
Did no one ever pick up for you in school? Like, did no one ever say, stop?
No. No.
No one ever put an arm around you and say, it's okay, David.
No, not certainly not students, certainly not teachers, no. My mum, my dad, my brother, my mum's, I remember one day ringing my mum after school and I was like, I just can't deal with this anymore. And my mum rung and said, will you go to Rita's, who's one of her best friends who lived three doors up at the time. And I remember just going to Rita's crying. She'd put her arm around me, yeah, you know, friends and my nanny and my, they would, but not in school, no. It was at times a very lonely time. Yeah. But you know what? I've come out the other end of it now, and I hope those people never have to go through what my mum and dad had to go through as parents. I would never even wish that on my worst enemy. I hope that their child never has to go through what they inflicted on me. And maybe that sounds a bit angry when I say that, but I genuinely mean that. Like, I just hope that, you know, we've come a little bit further on with bullying and understanding. And I hope those teachers, you know, I think probably more than anything, I'm angry with the adults that were in that school. The teachers who should have been aware, who should have known what was going on, who were told that was going on by, you know, my mum. And they continuously pushed it under the carpet and allowed it slide. That is wrong. And I hope that they've changed. I'm not sure. I don't have anybody or know anybody that's got kids at schools that are a similar age now. You know, a lot of my cousins, nephews and nieces are all like just starting. But I'd be horrified to think that any of them would have to experience that. Yeah.
It's you know, like I did a podcast with James Patrice, and James said, I asked him about his bullies, and he says he sees them now, and he says they'll shout across the road, oh, my wife loves your page and loves what you're doing, and there's two kids in a pram or a child, you know, it's school uniform on, and he's like, thanks, and he's like, I hope to God your children never experience what you put me through.
What you inflicted on me. I just, so right, James. I love James, by the way, full disclosure. I think James is amazing. I think he is trailing the way for the LGBT community on primetime media, on the television, which is what we need more of, in my opinion. But he's right. I remember in Liffey Valley, my mum seeing one of my bullies, and I didn't even recognise him, and he was walking up with kids. And his wife and my mum said, when he seen me, he absolutely scoured and nearly ran into the building. And I thought, well, I hope he holds on to that feeling. And I hope that shame that he has influences him as a parent for his kids to, one, be better people than he behaved at school, but also to be able to have the instruments to deal with if their kids ever do get bullied. Because I wouldn't honestly wish it on them. I hope they never have to go what he, like James said, inflicted on James. Because it's just not nice. And, you know, look at James now. He's absolutely trailblazing. And it's so, it makes me, as a gay person, proud to see another person dealing with it so fantastically and to getting, you know, to where they are. And there's a load of us out there, and, you know, I don't want this to, you know, me to kind of, hopefully, I would never want to speak on anybody's behalf, or make out that I'm a victim, because I'm not a victim. I was, but I'm not anymore. Not a victim in the sense of, like, a victim is a strong word. A victim of bullying I was, but I'm a stronger person now, and... Yeah, it's just, it is so, kind of sitting here and talking and dissecting it with you, you just remember those feelings, and it was a lot, you know, a lot for kids to be dealing with.
A lot, Jesus. So tell me about the days in the drama and what that was like, because I did do a podcast before, but unfortunately we couldn't air it because the sound was just really bad, with Johnny Ward. Uh-huh. Yeah, and he talked about, you know, not failing, but the nose and all of that and how hard it's been for him. And I hope to sit down with Johnny again. But what was, first of all, the drama, the performing arts school like, and then, like, moving on into your career?
Well, that was one of the hardest kind of experiences of my life, in the sense of learning my craft. It was like an athlete school, you know. We were there every day, 8 till 6.
Was this in the UK?
Yeah, in a place in Essex. It was a professional musical theatre course. It doesn't actually exist anymore. Closed down about 2 years ago. But, you know, Jesse Buckley went there, not Jesse Buckley, Jesse J went there, a lot of the guys from the Inbetweeners, two of the girls, Rochelle Humes and Frankie Bridge from Saturdays Day went there, and then a load of musical theatre people and actors, and, you know, we were doing, you know, ballet, jazz, contemporary dance, tap dancing, acting through song, acting, singing, you know, physiology, lessons, kind of professional practice lessons, all these kind of lessons, and then it was literally September to July, 3 years, Monday, it wasn't just Monday to Friday, it was Monday, your weekend, you had homework and prep, and it was like a proper boot camp. It was fierce. The change in practices within drama skills has changed quite a lot over the years, and particularly at the moment now, because they were quite archaic. It was very old school, and that's what I had. But I've come to realise that that's not always the best way to teach. I think there has to be a fine balance, getting rid of that kind of old school, kind of hardcore stuff, because actually it pushes into the kind of injury, people not doing injury prevention and like that. But it was hardcore. It was three of the most amazing years, because I found myself a little bit. You know, I was prepping out and I was doing stuff that I loved. I couldn't believe this. Like, I was getting to live my musical theatre dream. Like, I was training. I mean, people that were in West End shows coming up and teachers. Like, this was like, oh my God, with celebrities coming and teachers. It was amazing. And I was very lucky. And, you know, I will remember those 3 years a lot. But then again, like I said, you know, personally, you go through a big journey as well on that. And that takes on board all the stuff from your past that influences your future, you know. So, yeah.
Did you skip over there, or was it, oh my God, I don't want to leave my mum and dad?
I skipped, which my mum couldn't believe, because I was the one who didn't want to move when I was younger.
Yeah, that's what, like, you were saying that ever earlier on. Yeah. You didn't want to move, that, you know, Stockholm syndrome, and then this opportunity comes before you.
Yeah.
And you just skipped.
Just absolutely skipped. I loved it. I couldn't believe it. I was sharing a room with someone I never knew in the student house. I just loved it. I don't know what. It was like someone, like a divine angel or something, came over me and took over my body and just kind of led the way. And then, yeah, 13 years later, I'm still there. Like, it's mad.
Well, how did your mum and dad feel in the airport saying, was the airport to say goodbye to you? Yeah.
Well, mum dropped me off the airport. Of course, she was distraught. When you naturally would be, wouldn't you, if I was your son? And then, Dad, it was the first time I seen him emotional. He came over to the house with me, and then him and my brother left to fly back home. And yeah, it was. I think a lot for us. Really, it was a lot. And what I will say is, my mum and dad have gone without some me and my brother could go with. And for me and Joseph to follow our dreams, they went without. And I don't think I'll ever be able to make up to them what exactly that means. What it means to me and my brother, what they did, and how they got us through drama school and still support us both emotionally and embrace us still with even any problems. You know, they're just amazing people, and yeah, I'm so lucky.
You are?
I am.
Tell me, is it true that both you and Joe came out on the same day?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, exact same.
Did you just
day.
Have a conversation beforehand?
No, or Joseph was fuming, because I was down about it. Again, the whole thing of, I can't tell my mum I'm gay. They're going to, you know, that negative the little man on the shoulder saying, don't forget, being gay is wrong, being gay is wrong. Everyone's told you it's bad. You're queer, you're a puff, you're a faggot. And I was just texting my mum one day and she said, you're all right. I said, she had it like she knew like there was something wrong. And I said, I'm sad. And she went, why? And I just texted back saying, I'm gay.
Right.
And her reply was, is that all? And I was like, oh, okay. And then my mom told my dad, and my dad is at home with my brother, and he said, you know, David's just come out to your mom. And my brother was like, fuck's sake. But we both knew each other was gay, but he didn't know I was going to come out on this day. Right. And my dad is like, so, you know, if you ever need to tell us anything, Joe, we're more than happy to, you know, I hope you feel like you can. Mm. And Joe goes, yeah, I'm gay as well. Right, I'm just popping out to see my friends. I'll see you later. And off you went out, and they FaceTimed me that night. I was bawling, crying, and they were like, what are you crying for?
Why were you crying?
Because I was ashamed. I felt ashamed. I felt it was wrong. I was worried people would be different to me.
Were they?
Somewhere, yeah, somewhere. Some people were. Yeah, they were. But, again, being gay wasn't in people's living rooms. There wasn't two gay men dancing on Strictly. There wasn't two gay men dancing on Dancing on Ice. There wasn't a lot of gay representation on the television. There wasn't a lot of gay representation on the radio, on print media, anything like that. So some people weren't. The people I love most were fine. And that includes my cousin Linda, my cousin Paul. They were all fine. It was almost like an exorcism. And actually, the reason why me and my brother had told each other was my brother was at a party where it was over at my student house and we were training, and a girl, I had told one girl at college I was gay, and she had told another girl, and this girl was going around telling everybody at the party that I was gay. And I was like, for fuck's sake, if my brother finds out. So then I ended up telling my brother, and he's like, yeah, me too. And then we hugged it out. And I think that's why we are so close, is that we've kind of been on this journey together. And the way the four of us are so close is because we've always been a team. And I think we always will be, hopefully. You know, the four of us together, we got each other's backs and stuff like that. So, yeah.
How do you feel about those people who didn't understand or didn't?
I don't hold too much anger or frustration, because when people don't understand things, they get ignorant and they get defensive. And like we said earlier on, just having a conversation can alleviate all that. But sadly, I'm not going to enter into a conversation about me being gay, because nobody had to come out astray. Nobody had to ring around and make phone calls and say, oh, just so you know this. So for me, it was very important that we didn't go around telling everybody like it was like, hear ye, the O'Reilly brothers are now gay. Do you know what I mean? If people asked, they could absolutely be told, of course, yeah, I'm gay. But I wanted the narrative, and Joseph did, and I think my mum and dad did to a certain extent, wanted it not to be that thing of, oh, you know, David and Joseph are gay. Like, it was shameful. Like, it was wrong. So for me, because I did feel so much shame, I wanted to reclaim it and take control of it and say, no, this is not going to be a thing of where we have to go and tell people. People ask, they can, that's fine, we'll tell them. This is my story and my brother's story for us to tell, no one else's. And so I'm happy to have a conversation about queer culture, about, you know, trans, about race, social structure amongst race and culture and sexuality. But what I won't do is encourage anyone to have a coming out or to tell them about coming out, because actually that just makes it seem like it's something that needs to be told to everyone, because it's unusual. And actually, the sooner the better we kind of get rid of that thing of just people just are gay. They walk among us, you know.
Yeah.
People are gay. Some people are non-binary. Some people are trans. And that is it. Mm. It's as simple as that. Mm. And the sooner the better we just realise and just get on, I think we will come so far. And I hope I don't come across negative here as well, because actually what I am really proud of as well, Ireland being the first ever country to vote in equal marriage through popular vote. I mean, hello. You know, that's amazing. Like, in a society and culture that was run by that church, you know, we've come to the other end now, and we're like voting in equal marriage. Like, I just want to, if I wore, I should really probably wear a bra, but if I wore one, I take it off and burn it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's mad because, like, two things. My aunt, her daughter is gay, and my cousin, she's a lesbian, and she's in a beautiful relationship. But they, a woman said to her, "No, you're going to get your flag out for Pride." And my aunt said, "Sorry." She said, "You're going to get your flag out." And she said, "Why? Should I have mine now? Where's yours?" And she said, "I don't need a flag." She says, "I'm proud of my daughter every day."
Yeah.
She said, I don't need a flag outside my door to show my daughter that I'm proud of her. She knows I'm proud of her every single day.
Yeah. Oh, the other one is, oh, you're both gay? Oh, they're upset they're not going to have grandkids.
Oh, God.
Why won't they have grandkids?
Yeah.
You think that having a baby is a man and a woman? Okay, right, okay, cool. But you know...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
How gay people can adopt children and give them the most incredible life, you know, and that has been, you know, done for years. But okay, you know, it's so mad that, but then I don't get angry at that because people don't understand. Mm. But when you say it, they will. So, you know, it's all about having those conversations and just... Education is key, and that's why it should be part of the school curriculum, but that's a debate in itself.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Also, do you think the Strictly thing was that a bigger thing in the UK than it was here? Was that huge, like in the UK, that there was two men dancing on Strictly?
Oh my God, it was so big to see two men on primetime television doing a competition that for 19 years, I think it's in series 19.
Wow.
Had been done with only male and females. Like, that way it was. And the Johannes and John, who are the couple, did a dance a few weeks ago. And I just remember bawling my eyes out crying because I actually think my journey may have been a little bit different if I had seen this on television, because representation matters, you know? You know, you want to see a straight white woman on the television, you turn it on, you can find it within 2 seconds. Mm. You want to see a straight white man, you can turn it on and find it in 2 seconds. You want to find a gay person, a unicorn in Ireland is a gay person of colour. I mean, that finding that in the media is impossible over here, and it's wrong. I mean, you need more of it, and having that representation, seeing those two men dance and not change anything, dancing like a man and a woman. And actually, Shirley Ballas, who's one of the judges on it, put it so perfectly, is when dancers are growing up, there's not an awful lot of quotas of men, a lot of girls dance together. So she's like, this has been going on for years, you know? Let me tell you, this is why it needs to be part of Strictly. But the hate has been awful to see as well. But I hope that, you know, Dancing with the Stars Ireland is coming up in January and February, and I really hope they have a same-sex couple. I hope they embrace it, because I think that they don't, RTE and Shinna Will, I think Shinna Will are the producers, they don't know the power that will bring to so many young gay members of the LGBTQ+IA community. It really will just offer this. It's like someone coming over and just patting you on the back and saying, see, it's all right. Don't worry, it will. It's all right. You know, that's so important.
That's huge.
Yeah, it is. It is.
That's, like, again, you're just giving me moments like that. Someone, like, patting the back and saying, look.
It's like a warm hug. And even, like, getting the opportunity to do Elaine and be her showbiz correspondent. You know, Elaine gave me a job, a lad in London, as a panellist on her show. No one knew me. No one knew who I was. I'd never done anything over in Ireland. She was the only one that ever gave me a chance, an opportunity. Ryan Tuberty had me on his radio show, sorry. But Elaine was the only one who gave me this huge opportunity to kind of be a member of a panellist show in Ireland. It was incredible. And then to be openly gay and talk about my experiences on the panel, but then also bring that into the showbiz correspondence and have that rapport with her, and how, you know, she's such an amazing ally to the gay community. Yeah, they are. They are, because actually what allies do is, and people think that it's just about people just do it now to be popular and just so, well, I have to agree because it's cool enough. But what allies actually do is they take people by surprise, because when people who aren't a member of that community take a stand for that community, you shift the narrative and go, the person goes, oh, because it's not just a gay person talking about gay rights because they're gay. This straight person's sticking up for them. So they, oh, okay, this is different. Why are you... It takes away the unconscious bias that people have and think that people are biased because of their given circumstances. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. You know, so allies are so important.
Yeah, I like that. And where did you and Elaine meet?
On the show. I emailed the show.
Did you?
I said, I think I'll be a good panellist. I'm this and that. Met her on the set.
Fabulous.
Met her on the set for the first day in the old studio. So anybody who doesn't know, Virgin Media's got two studios. The new studio and the what they call the old studio, I think. It was the old studio. And at that time, the 6 o'clock show, Expose, the news and Elaine were all in one building, in one studio. And that's where I met her for the first time. And yeah, I think I was a gobby little shy. And she was like, oh, okay.
I like him.
Get him back. He might talk a bit. And then she knew I was struggling during the pandemic because I had no work. Obviously, theatres were closed. And she said, would you like to be the showbiz correspondent? Do a weekly roundup of all... That's where a roundup of O'Reilly came from. And do the showbiz correspondence.
Your little logo and everything.
Yeah, my little logo. That's where Elaine... I mean, so I'll be forever grateful for her, actually, for putting a gay person on a primetime slot of her show every week, and also supporting someone as well. Very important.
Tell me about your first big interview and what that was like. Audition, not interview, your audition. Do you remember?
Terrible. It was for Spring Awakening in Germany. And
what is that?
Spring Awakening is a musical. It was a musical, not very rarely done, very rarely done now, I think, but it was big back in the day. It was the first production being done outside of the usual production. So it was a new production of in Germany. And I remember going into the room and the director was an arsehole. And totally unnerved me, and stood in the middle of the room, went to sing, and I was like, oh, oh, oh. And it was awful. I remember walking out going, okay, so what do you think I'm going to get that? But then it wasn't long after that I got my first big job, and you learn auditions, we put so much pressure on it. It's just a job interview at the end of the day, and I've taken away that importance of it as well now. I go in, I show them what I can do, and then I leave, and that is it. I forget about it then.
How long did it take you to get there, that mindset?
I graduated in July of 2010, and I opened in Greece. I started rehearsals for Greece, the musical, in the January 2011.
But the mindset,
How long did it take me to get the mindset? Oh, God, the last year, maybe 10 years into the business, having the confidence, having jobs behind me to feel like I'm worth saying things like that. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. Not in an ego way, but like, at the end of the day, I can only go in and do what I can do.
Mm.
And that may or may not fit the jigsaw that's sitting in front of you for the jobs. And if it doesn't, well, there's nothing more I can do because that's all I can do. Mm-hmm. You know, if I went in unprepared, not knowing my content, my scripts, my songs, or I wasn't prepared, it's easy to walk away and feel like you've let yourself down. But when you go into an audition and you've literally done everything that you can possibly do, you can't get annoyed at yourself.
Mm.
And the audition process used to be so hard. I mean, some people had 13 auditions for Legally Blonde and they didn't get the job. I mean, hello. But now we're in a different place. I'm in a different place where I go in, I do what I need to do, and I leave. And that's it. I forget about it. Or I do a self-tape for a TV job, I submit it, and then I leave it. And that's it. That's all I can do.
Tell me about Greece. What was it like? One opening night, but then was your parents at opening night, or what was that like?
I had so many people opening night. And it was terrible. I don't know if anyone's ever seen Greece. The production that I did was the original production that happened in 1993 at the Dominion Theatre. It watered itself down right up until I did it in 2011 at the Piccadilly Theatre, which Moulin Rouge is at the moment in London's West End. And the show opens with Danny and Sandy coming out singing either side, and they go, and we go straight into Greece is the word, and this curtain comes up and there's smoke, and we're all standing by, and I was shaking. I think I even meant to go early on one of the first moves.
What part did you play?
I played Roger, one of the T-Birds, but he's not called Roger in the film. Right. There's five T-Birds, Danny, Kinnicky, Sonny, Roger and Doody, and I was Roger. And he sings the song, but he's a larger character. And yeah, I will never forget that moment. And my dad always says, like, he's like, yeah, we were just going along with it. And then he said, it wasn't until I got into the theatre and I seen your name up on the board. Like, I was like, Jesus Christ, this is big. And it was. And I made friends for life in that job. And I truly feel that job was the one where I kind of let my shoulders down a little bit. And I think I can start to enjoy life a little bit. I found my people, my tribe.
And you've travelled the world.
I have. I've been very, very lucky. I'm very lucky with my jobs, and you know,
blessed, because you worked hard. Look, you've just told me how hard you had it all these years to travel the world. So you're not lucky.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, yeah, you're right. You're right. Yes, take our bras off again. And yeah, I've been to Australia, New Zealand. I'm going to America to do a job. I've done jobs in England. I've been very, very lucky that my chosen career that I've wanted to do, that I love so much, has afforded me so much more than just a job. It's afforded me the chance to see some of the world, work with incredible, amazing people, and take money home at the end of the week from it as well. And that's all really you can ask for, isn't it?
And what were you doing when you were in Australia, New Zealand? What show were you doing?
I did the Catherine Tate live tour there, and we had the most incredible experience. There was four of us in the cast. Catherine Tate, obviously, Nikki Wardley and Alex Carter. Alex Carter is probably best known for being in Emmerdale and Hollyoaks, and Nikki has done all the Catherine Tate stuff. She's to her, you know, I'm above it. She's the other girl with her. And we did 2 weeks rehearsals in London, then we did a week of tech. And it was like another world. I was just like, and it was amazing to watch Catherine. She knows her brand. She knows who she is. She knows what works. She knows what doesn't. And then we flew business class. She made sure we were all, it was like being a rock star. Like this experience, I was like, oh my God. We went and we flew, we landed in Perth. We spent a week there. And then we literally went Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Canberra, Brisbane, Newcastle, Sydney, over to Auckland, Wellington, Palmerston North, down to Christchurch, back up to Wellington, and finished in this 20,000-seater arena in Auckland on our last show. And then we were able, after all that, to take the show into London's West End for 3 weeks. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, because I got to see family out in Australia as well, and spent quality time with my cousin Lynn and Paul, and Lynn's little boy, my nephew Charlie. I say he's my nephew because he is. And see them, see my mom's cousins, see one of my other second cousins in New Zealand. I got to experience this and be paid for it. And to do an amazing show every night. Like, yeah. It was mad. It was just mad.
What is it like when family come in? Like, are you so proud to bring them back? Like,
yeah, I am. I mean, I love when mum and dad come to see a show because they're as much part of this journey as I am. And, you know, dad wants the programme and the poster and everything like that. And mum, you know, mum would say about what she loved about the show. And they were never like, you know, like stagey parents, like they were never pushy with like that sort of stuff. So when they come and see, I genuinely am just intrigued to see if they're enjoying the show. And, you know, it's so great when they do. And I've had so many aunties and uncles come and see it and friends. And I just love that experience of them being able to come and see, because a lot of people don't understand what being an actor is. They think that in order to be an actor, you have to have been, you're not successful unless you've been on The X Factor, EastEnders, or in a big film. Everything else in it doesn't really matter. It doesn't, not on people's radar. So when they come to the West End and see me performing, or even in regional theatre or on tours or my stuff on a lane, that's a real sense of pride for me because it's a representation of my work.
It's fabulous. It is.
Like, but I sound like a right wanker, don't I?
No, you don't. I'm like, I absolutely love it. I love it all. Like, I love it all. And I know a friend of mine, she's in London, my friend's sister, Audrey, and her son, he is doing all, Emmett, he's in all the performing arts.
Amazing.
And he's doing all the shows and pantos and stuff like that. And he's only gone 21, and I know he's going to be a huge star. I know he's going to be fab. And she's the biggest stage mom. She's not like a bad, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
stage
mom. Encourages that and embraces it.
Yeah, she really does. So I'm just like sitting here looking at you, and I can't wait just to finish this and to say, oh, Audrey, can't wait till you hear this. Do you know what I mean? Because I know she'll love it. Like, she'll love it every minute of it. Tell me about, then you went and you did Benidorm. What was that like, and other like bits that you've done?
That was mad. That was my first ever TV job. And I was going in as the first ever character from Ireland into this massive British institution of comedy legends and icons. I was going in the end of series 9, and my first day on set was with two actors, Jay Canuso and Sherry Hewson. And I was shitting myself. I'd never done TV before. I didn't know what all these things meant. You know what I mean? And
is it very different?
Oh God, yeah, because theatre, you rehearse for 3 weeks and then you go and you do the same show every night for a year. Basically, essentially. TV is a lot of waiting around. You know, you get your pickup, you go to your trailer, you then go to hair and makeup, you then go back to your trailer, you're then brought to set. Everybody does a line run. Then, depending on directors have different ways. Then we do a blocking, a rehearsal. Then we shoot it. Then we change cameras. Then we shoot it again. Then we'll change cameras again. And you've got to make sure that you're doing the same thing in every single take for continuity. And I've never done all this. And I'm hearing words like, make sure you do this, make sure that. I'm like, I don't know what that means. So I was petrified. So I just kind of really tried to throw myself into it. And I got invited back for series 10 to do an episode as well. And I loved it. I loved the experience of going out to Spain. I loved the experience of being part of that amazing cast. Tony Mosley, who played Kenneth the hairdresser, is still a really, really good friend of mine. And Julie Graham and Sherry Hewson, I still speak to a lot of the other actors. And and Darren, who's the creator as well, you know, I'm so grateful for him to give me the opportunity. And just being part of this kind of massive ensemble cast of a really, you know, British loved comedy, and was just a massive kind of deal for me. And I'm so proud to have been a very small part of it. One, to be the first ever person from Ireland to do a character, and to get to do amazing scenes. It was, yeah, I was just so bowled over with excitement, pride, and just real kind of sense of, Jesus Christ, is this actually happening? Like, is this real? Do you know what I mean?
And before we could talk about Jamie, because I think that in itself is totally huge. Like, that's a huge thing. But tell me about, and you've said it, you know, you can only be yourself, but through the years, just perhaps to help people, when you've had a no, and what was your biggest no, and how did you deal with it?
The biggest no, I would probably say, was when I did, I was standby at the Book of Mormon.
Oh, wow.
For 5 years, and there's a natural kind of progression for some people. They feel like they're going to take over the part, or they should take over the part. And I think I kind of learned after the first year or two that my job was purely just to be there as a standby. I didn't give any more grace in that. But I think not taking over was probably one of the best gifts at the time it felt hard. I felt like maybe I wasn't worthy enough or I wasn't good enough to take over the role, and actually it was just down to one person didn't want me to take over. That was one producer didn't, and you know, they decided after 4.5 years that my time was going to come to an end in the January, and they wanted me to work with my counterpart that was taking over for me for that time. But I got a job in September and I left in the December, so I waved off. But what I will say is that the producer, the English producer on that show, Sonia Friedman and her team, are some of the greatest people, and made those 4.5 years the most amazing years ever. I came into work and I loved coming into work, and I loved my job. I loved going on every now and again for this role, this big role. And they looked after me, and they kept me so well in regards to like treating me well in the workplace, that, you know, I'm so forever grateful for Sonia Friedman Productions and the production company, because they looked after me, and even now they come and support me in other shows, and that means a lot as an actor, you know, for people to come and see you in shows after you've finished working with them. That's huge. It's people taking time out of their schedule to come and see you.
I think that's still, like, God, such a long time of being a standby. I wouldn't say everyone handles it so well.
No, some people don't, and that's okay as well. I had a choice. I could either go with it or I could let it define me and define my experience. And actually the greatest thing, now looking back on it, was hard leaving the show. But I've been so lucky since. I've been blessed. I really have been blessed to work. I left that show and went straight into doing a play with Kathy Burke, directed by Kathy Burke with Jennifer Saunders. I then went from that to then going to Australia with Catherine Tay. I got to do Doctors on the BBC, another episode of Benidorm. I got to go and do Everybody's Talking About Jamie. I got to do a whole cartoon series. You know, so I am so focused on that experience of being scared of leaving a job, but actually going into these other jobs just totally took away any sort of possibility of resentment or anything like that. Does that make sense? Of course, yeah. I still joke about it now, you know what I mean? To friends and all that, and they find it very funny. But yeah, it learning to, I think always with every decision, when it comes down to circumstances, choices and emotional turmoil, you kind of look at it, I think it's very good to look at it and go, am I going to let this define me? Am I going to let this situation define me? Or am I going to, and that again goes back to the bullying. I can't let this be my narrative, because if I do, I've succumbed to, and I'm losing out on time. Is that me?
No, it's the ice
story. I'm losing out on, and you know, I've just gone through a breakup at the moment, about a month and a half ago, and you know, today particularly was a bit of a hard day, and my mom just said to me, you know, you've got to write through this, but remember, don't let it define you. Don't let your past define your future, because if you do, you're remaining in the past. And I think as people, it's hard. We've got to acknowledge the problems. We've got to acknowledge the grief. We deal with them properly, healthily, and then we try and carry them through as a piece of armour, as opposed to some self-hate, because then we're just carrying it through and it just becomes a lot of old shite.
How long was that relationship?
It was 18 months. Yeah.
Is that why you're home?
I was coming home anyway, but why I'm home for so long, yeah. Yeah, it was hard. First one in 10 years. Really? And it's so much better than it was. Like when I was a month and a half ago, like, I just wish I was one of those people that stopped eating when they were upset. You know what I mean? Because I'd be a lot skinnier now if that was the case. But I think I eat more it's fine, because actually it's I'm going to use it as a string to my bow. Remember where it applied to some of my acting, and remember that actually I'm a kick-ass person, I'm important to so many people, and I'm not gonna let this define me. I'm not.
Good for you. Don't.
I won't.
Because you're fabulous.
Thank you, darling. You too.
Tell me about, I want to talk about the post you put up this week, but before that I want to talk about Jamie. And is that a very new thing,
you know? So Jamie is a musical. Everybody's Talking About Jamie, and it's a new British musical that came down to the West End in 2017, I believe, from a regional theatre based on a true story. okay. about a boy that wanted to go to his prom in a dress. There's a documentary on BBC about it. Jamie Campbell, a guy from up north, I think it's Middlesbrough, wanted to go to his prom. The teachers wouldn't let him into the prom with the dress on, but the students wouldn't go into the prom until they let Jamie in.
Wow.
And they ended up doing it. And so what they've done is they've made this stage show. Dan Gillespie-Sells from The Feeling, Tom McCrea, and Johnny Boyle created this amazing story. And it's absolutely mind-blowing to see it be so welcomed to the mainstream commercial theatre industry. It just closed after like 5 years on the West End, and now it's going to LA and it's on a UK tour, and I got the chance to be part of it on an 8-month contract just before, like in the January of the pandemic. Right. So I did 3 months and then we closed. But then I went back to it for 4 shows on Christmas and we closed again. And then I just went back into it this May and I just finished at the end of September. And I'm about to go back out with it to LA in January and February. And the great thing about this story is it looks at the relationship between the son and the mother and the how the mother embraces the authenticity of her child and goes along with her son's real life lived experience, because she just accepts him for who he is, and her friend accepts him for who he is. And there's one bully in the play, but the majority of the students love Jamie for who he is, because they know that there's nothing wrong with him, like, you know. And that's what, that was just an amazing world. But obviously he does go through a hard time within the story. It wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be very nice to watch if it was just the same kind of, oh, this is great. And I don't want to give it away in case anybody hasn't seen it, but it's just such a wonderful, beautiful story that I think will really resonate. And I hope one day it comes to Ireland, and I hope that it does a residency somewhere. Somewhere even like the Gaiety or the Olympia, just this show comes so people can come and see it, because actually I think it would do people an amazing gift to just watch it and just experience it. And it then became a movie and just came out. Have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't seen it.
You should watch it. It's incredible. The movie is like fucking amazing. And yeah, it's just become this bit of, it's opened in Korea, it's gone to Australia, I think it's going to go to South Africa. It's just completely gone over all the world, and it's going to be around for a long time, and I'm very proud to be part of it. I play a character called Like a Virgin, one of the drag queens, and it's great. We come out, we have fun, we tell this amazing story, and then have a big dance and big mega mix at the end. It's such a joy and a privilege to be part of it. Really is.
Look at you.
Because sometimes you have part of shows and they're fucking shy, and you're like, oh, it's such an honor and a privilege. But this genuinely, yeah. I am so honoured to be part of it. I really am.
David O'Reilly from Kilmainham, look at you.
Kilmainham.
Where's Kilmainham?
Kilmainham is in Tala.
All right, Kilmainham. Look at you, though. Like, taking over the world. It's amazing.
Ah, stop, hardly.
No, like, it's just amazing to see.
Thank you so much.
Tell me about, there was a post, did you put it up with someone that someone was attacked some drag queens in the UK?
Yeah.
Is it a homophobia? A huge problem. I know, and I spoke to James, and it is here. Is this, like, the UK, they moved on, or is it still a huge problem?
It's still a deep-rooted part of society, and I'm not sure it will ever go away, because homophobia, you're not born homophobic. Mm. You're taught homophobia. Mm. You learn it from the people you're around and the things that you watch, and that's why, as a gay person, it's so important for me to try and encourage change on our mainstream media, a positive change. I'm not preaching for anything other than just tell queer stories. Like, how many gay sitcoms has there been on Irish TV about a gay friendship circle? I've got one waiting to go,
yeah,
but I can't get in the room to get it made.
That's crazy.
Like, I wanted to get made. It's called, it's just 2 series that have got really massively Irish gay content in them. And I would give my right arm to have them on TV. So I hope one day, if it's not mine, that somebody's dream, someone's lived reality of being queer in Ireland gets made. But in the UK, the problem is that there is a lot of attack. I mean, we've seen it in Spain, that guy getting kicked to death,
yeah,
in Madrid. I mean, that's a scary thing, because actually he was killed because he was gay. So instantly you go, you, as people, we always compare ourselves to other people. So I look at him and say, well, he was gay. He was killed for being gay. That drag queen was pushed to the floor the other day because they wanted her to pull up her skirt so they could see her genitals. That was literally, and people think that drag queens are some sort of petting zoo, I believe, you know. And people come to Soho for a good night, you know, geez, we'll go to Soho, have a great crack with the gays, you know, that kind of sort of mentality. Mm. And it's changed over the years because it's gone quite commercial now. That's a little safe space. It was a little hub of
community.
It was a safe space for some young queer people to go and have drinks and not feel like they're going to be battered when they're walking out on the streets. And actually where it comes from is it needs to come from schools. And this is why people say, no, you can't teach about being gay in school. You don't pick gay up from reading books. You're not going to catch gay because you're sitting within 2 meters of me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Teaching about gay history and gay culture, what it does is it gives people an understanding to go, oh God, this is actually quite part. There is actually, and not this kind of thing of, you know, so-and-so's son is gay. Mm. You know, so-and-so's daughter is a lesbian. Like that, when we speak like that, what we do is, even like just going like that, you know, so-and-so's gay. Mm. That is making it, you're hushing your tone, you're making it as if it's a secret or something to be ashamed of. So the homophobia rises from the home, from what these people are seeing and being taught. And then, you know, my brother gets called batty boy or gay in London, I'd say once a month, if not more, when he's walking, because he dresses incredibly. He's a fashion icon. Anybody check his Instagram out, Joseph O'Reilly, because he's a stunning icon. And that's his lived reality, you know? The same with me, if I'm on the phone and someone takes the piss out of my voice and, you know, this is what we're dealing with. So as much as London is this real accepting kind of, and it is accepting, don't get me wrong, you know, with regards to, we also have a government that's in power, that were the ones that brought in Section 28 over in the UK that forbid the teachings of anything gay because it was considered propaganda right up until the year 2000.
Oh my God.
Like that was in, the Tories brought that in. Sorry, it's getting very political now. Mm-hmm. But they're in power now. Mm-hmm. And that was called Section 28. And do you know what stand there at the Tory conference? They put the LGBTQ. 28. 28. Imagine doing that. Who? Like that just sums it completely up. So whilst it is an accepting and amazing community, and I'm so proud to be part of it, there's so much more work to be done. And I unfortunately start with the younger community in schools and our homes and parents understand them. But how can you do that if there's nothing on the telly, or there's nothing in the pages of the papers or the books to talk about this stuff? Do you know what I mean?
Very true. Really true. Tell me about, as well, I'm going to move on as well, like that, we'll take about the Dancing with David. Like, I had a look at your Instagram today just to have a look through it, and I was like, oh my fucking God, who are those other two people that are with you? And Jesus Christ, that's like...
We just saw over lockdown. I was in my home. So my friend Amy owns her property. We live in South West London, and her fiance, her, me, and her other best friend Craig all live together. And obviously, don't know about you, but during the lockdown when there was nothing happening, you try and make your day up. So we thought, she'd put up a few videos of me pissing around dancing, and people loved them. So we said, well, we'll do dance lessons every day, but they weren't dance lessons; they were just me taking the piss. And I knew the best thing about my dance. Dance with Dave was them laughing.
Yeah.
Was their reactions to me doing this show. That was the best thing. And that's where it came from. And then it kind of grew and lots of people tuned in every day.
River Dance.
And the River Dance was ridiculous. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And we just had fun and just, you know, so many people over lockdown, so many amazing people. My friend Chris Hall did some videos over lockdown. He's like, 37,000 followers on Instagram now. He's built up a following and a brand from doing the millennial at home during the lockdown. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so brilliant. So, yeah, that's where that came from. We just kind of let it grow. And then I did a show recently in London, my live comedy show. And I'm toying with maybe doing one in Dublin.
You should.
And I brought the guys up on stage. They didn't even know. And we did a dance with Dave.
What was your to date? What has been two things? What has been the person in the industry that has really probably not changed your life, but given you the best piece of advice. And then what on that, and then the side note to that is, what is the best part you've, if you can, that's like me, someone say to me, what's the best episode? But like, if you
yeah, yeah. Do you know what? There's not one person. There, my training involved a village of people, but I'm going to name some people that kind of, you know, influenced me. It was a lady called Michelle Blair, who runs an agency now, but she was my course leader at college, and she took me under her wing, and she pushed me harder than anybody's ever pushed me before. She taught me about high standards and trying to achieve for the best version of yourself and achieving the greatest possible outcomes. She did Stephen Mayer, you know, awarded me his award, a massive choreographer in the UK. But Flick Swan was the reason that I went and trained in England. She came to Ireland to teach, did these mock auditions with the Sage School I was in, and she auditioned me, put me in, and then taught me. And she's actually a really good friend now. So Flick Swan would be one of the people that, you know, influenced me. Mark Smith, who is a deaf choreographer who taught me at college, watching his tenacity, his creativeness, and his love of life was so inspiring. But then also Damien Delaney, who used to come in, he's from Cork, and he'd been in every bleeding show on the West End, and see somebody Irish coming in to teach us at college, and he always gave me a chance to be in his numbers and kind of really encouraged me. I feel very lucky off that. So they would be the people that I was training with. And then, you know, there's been so many people since, and there's so many people who continue to kind of have my back and push me. And, you know, there's a director called Debbie Izzet who directed and created all the Nativity films. And I've met Debbie once, but we created The Gaze Days on YouTube over the pandemic, about five friends. It's on YouTube, The Gaze Days. And she directed it for me. I just asked, and she directed it for me. And I loved working with her. We've really bonded and made a friendship. And that's what I love about this business. It brings people together.
That's amazing.
So much. It is amazing. And I, you know, she hypes me up, and I hype her up, and I love that. And there's so many people on a personal level as well who, you know, that comes in. So yeah, it's mad.
And your most favourite part to play?
Do you know what? There is genuinely so many. I've just done a TV job, which I can't talk about yet, but I did an episode of a big American TV show. I filmed it about 3 weeks ago, and it's been one of my favourite days on set ever. It was just, oh God, I just felt like a new woman. I felt like a new woman. It was amazing. It was honestly, I was working with some incredible actors and actresses. And then theatre, you know, the Catherine Tate stuff was amazing. Getting directed by Cathy Burke in Lady Windermere Miss Fan, you know, being an Irish man in an Irish man's play who wrote it in London, and I was performing it in London, was like, oh my God. And I got to work with Jennifer Saunders. Jeffrey from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was in it. And, you know, so that. And then obviously musicals, I'll always have a soft spot for Grease, because it was my first, you know, it was my first time getting on stage and doing that 8-show week kind of marathon. And yeah,
Real quick question before I let you go. Did anyone, like, that you met disappoint you? Either their craft or their personality? And maybe you can't say who that person is.
There's always going to be people you don't click with on jobs. And this has been so many over the years where they may not like me. And that's fine. You know, I'm an acquired taste. I never have any ill intentions or anyone. I am who I am. And sometimes people, it's either overpowering or they just don't want to, you know, and that's fine. You know, celebrity-wise, you know, you meet celebrities in the circus that you kind of go, Jesus, I'm glad I'm not talking to them. None that I've worked with, the full disclosure, but just flipping the question, actually, and I remember when we did Lady Windermere's Fan, and I was working with Jennifer Saunders and Cathy Burke, but then there was also a lady called Samantha Spiro, who I had seen play Hello Dolly Levi in Hello Dolly at Regent's Park in 2008, and I was like totally besotted with her, and begot, and she's a big TV actress. She plays Barbara Windsor in all the Barbara Windsor like flashback series and all.
Yeah.
And she was in this play as well with me. And I remember looking at her, Jennifer and Cathy rehearsing and talking, and I was like, fuck, this is kick ass. Three amazing women at the top of their craft, just being absolutely brilliant. And I'm so lucky I can say that the three of them are friends now, and I speak to them and I adore them. And I sat there open mouthed, watched three professionals create something so brilliant, And I was like, I'm going to take that and put it into my little notebook of remembrance and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Come here, what about, I just want to ask you this one. This,
ask me as many questions
thing.
As you want.
Miriam thing, what's her name?
Miriam Margulies.
What? She's mental, isn't she?
I am obsessed. If anyone wants to go onto my Instagram page, I have a thing called Have a Laugh. Mm. It's a folder of like things that make people laugh, and it is literally, there are so many of her, because I'll tell you one story that I don't know. My friend did Wicked with her, and they were going to a corporate gig after the show, so they got the tube, and Miriam was standing in the tube, and I don't want to say this too loud, her poor kids are in bed, and she's standing in the tube, and next to Sean sees her get this face, Miriam Margulies. She was like, she turned around, this man was standing right behind her very close, and she said, excuse me, will you take your cock out of my ass? front of the whole tube. And honestly, when Sean told me this story, I roared laughing. But she has so, watch, go back onto YouTube and watch. If I'm ever feeling down, I go and watch. And actually, I've just read her audiobook. I listened to her audiobook, and it's fascinating. It is so amazing to hear the stories and the way she talks to her openly. And did you see the fart video someone sent me? Someone sent me a video of her farting, and I'm just roaring laughing. Mary Margulies farted. I mean, so silly, but she's such an incredible actress as well.
Have you met her?
I don't know if I could meet her. No. I don't get starstruck, but I think I would. No, I think if I met her, I'd want her to be my friend, and I'd be so disappointed if she didn't like me. And the thing is, she probably would, because she doesn't like anyone. No, I'm joking. She doesn't like people, but she's so honest. Did you watch Graham Norton last week? She was on it.
Not last week, the first time. She was
on it last week, and they were talking about how she gets her breasts out to make people laugh. And Stephen Fry was on the show, and he said, he turned around to another actor and said, did you see Miriam took her breasts out? And the actor said, no, I didn't see them, I heard them.
Oh, David, I could talk to you all night. I really could. And I'm so happy that you're heading back to LA, because I know COVID was really hard for the theatre community, because even Carl Broderick and Panto, Carl's a friend of mine, and it was really hard for him and Panto and stuff like that. So I know how horrible it was for you, so it's great to see you doing so well, and I can't wait to see what that, because I know you went back, you were here, and then you went back to the UK to film that little secret thing.
Yeah, and I'm going back next week to see Panto before I could then go off to see LA, Jamie in LA. But thank you for having me on this. I've just listened to so many of your episodes, and I love your authenticity and your ability to chat, and the greatest thing about podcasts is when you just want to feel like you're sitting in the room with the people. So to be part of this, I'm honoured. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.